Greetings, Earthlings, and welcome to Are You For Real? My name's Tom, and with me as always is Grant.
What's up?
How's it going, everybody? I just wanted to remind everybody, if you like this podcast that we're doing here, please hit like and subscribe. It really helps us out a lot. We enjoy doing this, and we want to keep doing this. And every like and every subscribe and every comment we get helps us. So we'd appreciate that. So tonight, we are going to examine the story of Bob Lazar. For those of you who don't know, Bob Lazar is famous for claiming to work on extraterrestrial technology that was secretly being back-engineered by the U.S. military at Area 51, the existence of which was not known to the public at the time. He said that he worked in a removed area called S4. Lazar has also been in the public eye recently as he has been promoting a documentary covering his story, most famously on the Joe Rogan Experience podcast. There's also a documentary out called Bob Lazar, Area 51 and Flying Saucers, which is available on Netflix. So today, Grant and I will discuss the story that Lazar tells and all of the extraordinary claims that he's made. And then next week, we're going to examine the evidence that seems to validate his claims, as well as the evidence that seems to cast his story in doubt, if you will. And then we're going to discuss what we think about the topic as a whole.
That's right.
So, Lazar, he originally became known to the world in May of 1989 when he appeared on a local Nevada station TV interview with George Knapp, who has since gone on to Coast fame, I believe. In the original interview, Lazar disguised his identity by using a pseudonym and obscuring his face in shadow, but later that year he exposed his true identity in another interview.
Did he use a funny voice like this?
No, but it would have been definitely appropriate. I haven't been able to find the original Knapp interview, but we provided a link to what I believe is maybe the second interview in the show notes. There's no dates or anything on the video that I could find, but he seems about the same age as he is in the original interview video. You'll remember, I know Tom has seen the documentary, watched it together.
I have.
And did you listen to the Rogan interview too?
I did. I listened to almost all of it. No, actually I did listen to it. I listened to the entire thing.
Okay, cool. And Lazar's story, he seems to have remained fairly consistent throughout the years, and he tells a really compelling story in a seemingly open and honest manner. If you want to go right to the source, I would recommend listening to the early interview in full or maybe the recent Joe Rogan interview, and we've got the links to both of them in the episode description here. So, most of my firsthand information comes from these interviews. I have watched a lot of clips of older interviews and stuff, but
right.
I noticed when I was looking, there's an upcoming autobiography that Amazon has listed as available in September of 2019. So I'm definitely interested to read it, as I think it will really cement in my mind whether Lazar's full of beans or not.
Yeah. I was wondering if he's going to have a ghostwriter on that too, or if it's just going to be from his own hand.
When I was looking at it, it looked like it was his. I read a caption from it. And, I mean, it's definitely firsthand, you know, so.
Right, right.
But who knows what, you know, if he's writing it or not. I would imagine he is, but, anyway, that being said, let's get into Lazar's claims here. So.
Sure.
I think that Lazar's story has a lot of interesting aspects to it, which is probably why it's so popular. On the surface, he seems really believable and earnest, despite the fantastical claims that he's making. He seems rather nonplussed while discussing some amazing topics, but. As he says, once you get used to something, it just becomes the new normal. And I remember thinking that those touchscreen pads on, or like the communicators on Star Trek: The Next Generation, they seem so outside of reality at the time. But now I use a smartphone for basically everything without thinking twice about it. You know,
exactly.
He's also making an interesting point, or he makes an interesting point about how difficult the technology is to figure out, and how we, meaning the U.S. military or humanity in general, are limited by our own science. He says that basically we arrive at a bottleneck while researching and then can no longer make any progress with our current technology. And then we have to wait for science to catch up to make some more breakthroughs. He uses an analogy of dropping a motorcycle off in the Middle Ages. Eventually people would figure out how to turn the key and ride around on it, but how long would it take them to figure out how to synthesize plastic or fuel or anything like that, you know?
Right. He also used another powerful analogy of the nuclear reactor. in the Middle Ages, and then you know if they opened it up, everyone would die immediately, or pretty close to immediately.
Exactly.
And anyone around would, suffer horrendous effects, and they would think it was some kind of weird, I don't know, maybe witchcraft type of stuff, because exactly. they wouldn't have any kind of the gap in their scientific understanding is so vast compared to what ours is.
Well, it reminds me of people say that Nostradamus, you know, when he prophesies about the future, it was people looking into polished black stones or anything, you know, or something like that.
Yeah.
I mean, TVs or radios would blow someone from 200 years ago's minds, you know?
Yeah. Hey man, a smartphone would blow 6-year-old me's mind. And you know, I was 6 right. years old in 1987.
I mean,
the mind blow. I don't think we can overstate how mind blowing that would be.
Right. Or just watching a video on a computer like YouTube, you know, Napster. It was all mind blowing when it first came out, you know?
Yeah. And I think just to talk about Lazar himself and his claims that you were talking about, he seems pretty grounded for someone who's experienced all these amazing, fantastical things that he's claiming to have experienced.
Exactly. He just sits there and calmly relates everything that he says, you know, like in the same tone, basically, which, it's kind of fascinating.
Yeah.
So he makes a lot of claims that they're all pretty extraordinary. So I'll try to keep it brief, but we got to look at the details here. So,
sure.
The first overall claim that Lazar made is that the U.S. military has at least 9 alien aircraft and that they're attempting to back engineer at Section 4 in Area 51. He says that the basic goal is to understand the technology and then attempt to harness and replicate it. As Lazar says, all they could do is run as many experiments as they could think of to try to figure out how it worked.
It being the aircraft?
Okay. Exactly.
Yeah.
He goes into some detail about how the skunk works, top secret protocols worked. I think it's pretty fascinating, but he claims that he and at least 21 others had top secret majestic level clearance. It does seem odd to me that everything is so compartmentalized and on a need to know basis on the base, but then somehow Lazar still knew the exact number of people with clearance. And, maybe he keeps a running head in his, running a head count on the people he saw. But again, he doesn't really elaborate on this in the source that we've seen, but he's very confident about there was this many people, you know, which.
So he said there were 21 people in his compartmentalized area that were
working
on it. He said
it was me and 21 other people with majestic clearance is what he said, basically, as far as I remember.
Okay. So he wasn't clear about whether there were 21 people who had majestic clearance on the base, or was he just talking about 21... He and 21 other people, because I remember he mentioned someone named Barry, right?
Right, partner, yeah. Okay. That was his lab partner. Right. Well, that's the thing. It was compartmentalized. I don't know how he would know. Like, obviously he would see other teams, but...
Yeah, I wonder if there were 21 people in there at the same time with him.
Right, maybe, because I know he went on a bus... You know, he was bussed around, so maybe that's how many people were always in the bus or something.
Okay.
But he doesn't say. He doesn't elaborate, so it's all guesswork, you know, because that is interesting. Or maybe it was in the briefing that, you know, there's 11 teams or something like that.
Right.
But then I assume that he's counting the security protocol, you know, the security guards that were following around or around the base, and there was a guy following him around, like a military handler basically always following him. Making sure, you know, keeping them online, basically.
Yeah. I'm sure we're going to get into it more later, but I can't wait to discuss about how he found himself in this privileged position.
Exactly. Well, that's the thing, but it's unclear how, you know, he just drops all these knowledge bombs and then it's like, you don't know where it's coming from. And I mean.
And we'll get into it.
but basically the idea is it's compartmentalized, but he knows exactly how many people, but. Again, all he said was there was me and 21 others with majestic level clearance, and he seems to know a lot about the clearance levels and stuff.
Hmm.
So I haven't been able to find him saying this himself in an interview, but I have read through secondhand sources online that Lazar says that he was constantly followed by security while on site and would be called in at odd times to work, like the middle of the night. Lazar also goes into other details about how the classified research was carried out, but claims that the researchers all worked on a buddy system. So he was really only allowed to speak to his partner, who was Barry.
Barry.
Barack Obama.
Barry O.
And he wasn't able to speak with any of the other researchers. You know, he makes it clear like there was no conversation, no asking questions or anything like that. You just talk to your lab partner. That was in the Rogan interview, basically. He says that he worked there for approximately 6 months before he was cut off for being a security risk. And we'll get into that a little bit later. I think that just the cloak and dagger military stuff, like I said, is pretty fascinating. He claims that he was always bussed onto the site in a bus with blacked out windows. And the first thing that happened after he was read in was that he was given a briefing on the project to back engineer an aircraft.
So the blacked out windows are those blacked out windows so that he couldn't see out,
right?
Or so that people couldn't see in?
Well, that's a good question. I would imagine both, really.
Creepy.
And I'm not sure if this is like when you...
They could have just blindfolded
I think. I mean, I didn't go too into these protocols, but I believe it's like the airport there in the city, like they come off the flight and then they get into this bus and are just bussed in there.
Oh,
but I don't know. I mean, he knows exactly where it is, so I don't know what the point of the bus is, really, you know?
Yeah. And I guess maybe it's not that uncommon. I'll bet, like, you know, maybe prison buses and
right,
the transport convicts and everything might have blacked out windows too, but, or maybe no windows
or
at all.
I mean, maybe it's to cover up whatever else is going on the base, you know, if there's open hangars around there while they're driving them around or something like that. But my impression was that it was, you know, to keep them on a need-to-know basis, basically.
I hear you. Okay.
And he's given a briefing on the project to back engineer an aircraft. This included brief paragraphs about other aspects of the research, such as the alloys the craft was made of, the place of origin of the craft, the weapon systems, the distortion effects... well, time distortion effects, and the original inhabitants of the craft. It also included much more detailed information on the aspect that he was involved in, which was the power and flight systems. This had to do with gravity and anti-gravity ways, which also seemed pretty fantastical to him at the time, as he relates.
That's still pretty fantastical.
Yeah, exactly. I will get into some of the information that he read in the briefing in more detail after we review all the stuff that he claims that he can verify is true because he actually saw it with his own eyes.
So just to be clear, he was only involved in the power and flight systems. He wasn't involved with any of the supposed weapon systems on the craft or anything like that.
Exactly. So it was power and propulsion, basically.
That was his need to know stuff, was power and propulsion.
Exactly.
Okay.
And then he just got little brief paragraphs, as he says, to... you know, in case it was important to his research or something like that.
Got it.
I saw an interview where he said he opted to start with the generator and then the propulsion, but I'm not sure exactly what he meant by that. But I don't know if that was like his research strategy or if he like, he's like, no, I'm working on this. But I imagine
rank.
He was like, I'll figure out this generator first and then I'll get into how it moves or something.
He's pulling rank on the,
right.
The Area 51 military guys around there. He's like, I'm checking out the generator first.
I'm doing the alloys. I think it's an interesting point because in the original interviews, Lazar seemed much more willing to report this stuff as if it were all fact. But in more recent interviews, he seems much more comfortable sticking with what he claims that he can verify himself. As Lazar explains, when he originally read this stuff, he didn't know what the purpose was. He just thought maybe it was... It was pretty ridiculous, and he was being tested for how well he can memorize things, or maybe it was like a psychology test or something like that.
Like, what stuff are you referring to that he read?
Well, I mean, you know, he gets hired for this special project, or what do you call it? Yeah, I guess special project. And
special project.
Yeah, and he gets brought in, and then he gets his paperwork with, like, alien stuff on it. So he's like, what is this? Whatever.
Oh, you mean like the briefing?
The briefing, basically. Okay. So there's a lot of information that he conveys and claims, but he can't verify it. It's just like, this is what they told me. I didn't see any of it with my own eyes or anything.
Okay.
So he figures maybe it's some kind of test or something. You know, he's just going along with it, just reading it, thinking it's interesting, but, you know, it's all fantasy. And he says he's just excited to be in a top secret area and on an adventure, basically. It was an adventure for him. I know he was skeptical of UFOs before... before he became the Eric Snowden of UFO lore. But it does make sense that he seems unwilling to speculate on what he read, because as Lazar himself explains, it was probably sprinkled with disinformation as a sort of control. So if there's a leak, the military could track down who was leaking based on what particular piece of disinformation was being leaked. Does that make sense?
Right. Yeah, it does. So basically they could be saying, like, you will be dealing with a craft that has this kind of, that we assume has this kind of propulsion system. Also, this craft uses an it runs exclusively on unicorn farts or something. And so if he decided to leak to his buddies, going like, hey man, I'm working on a craft that runs on unicorn farts. And that gets out.
And then the story from an anonymous source comes out that
his is the only one unicorn that had the unicorn farts.
Exactly.
On.
Exactly. So Lazar, basically, he's just sitting there reading a bunch of information that seemed totally made up to him. And he also describes that later, when he was first led into the hangar, he saw your classic flying saucer just sitting there with an American flag decal on it.
Sweet. An American yeah. flag decal on it.
That is pretty rad. And he laughed to himself, thinking that all the UFO lore was really just based on some top secret man-made experimental craft sightings. So he says he absentmindedly reached out and touched it, and immediately was reprimanded. But then later, when he was shown a demonstration of the ship's generator by his lab partner, he had to reassess everything he had seen or read, basically, and he was witnessing something basically impossible to him, he said. And this is all in the, he explains this probably better than I do in the Rogan interview. But then Lazar says that he was instantly convinced once Barry fired up the generator and asked Lazar to try to touch it. He was unable to place his hands on the generator as it was surrounded by an anti-gravity force field, which felt like a magnetic field does on metal. His hands were you know, simply unable to get near the object, okay. Repelled from it.
Right.
As Lazar explains, the technology carries some pretty heavy implications with it. As he explains it, just the power that is required to create a gravity field is tremendous and borderline impossible with our current understanding of physics.
Yeah, I think he said, I don't even think it was borderline impossible.
Yeah.
Absolutely, 100% impossible.
Yeah, basically. Right? And also, time, space, and gravity are all closely related. So with this technology, you can basically bend reality around you as we understand it.
Oh. And just so you guys know, we're including a link in the show notes that includes photographs of a model of the alleged generator, as well as some analysis of the Lazar story itself.
Yeah, a lot of these links, they, you know, they have a lot of speculation on his claims as well, and you know, the well is bottomless with that stuff. But it does it has some pictures of Bob Lazar with a little model he made of it and stuff, so it's pretty cool.
Yeah, and it's difficult as a non-scientist to know what to take seriously. I have to say, he does a pretty interesting and pretty thorough job of explaining it in layman's terms to me, anyway.
Yeah.
I feel like I have a general grasp of how this thing runs. I don't understand the nuts and bolts of it, obviously.
Right. Well,
and it doesn't sound like anybody does. But to Lazar's credit, he's pretty down to earth and matter of fact, and I think he's a pretty he's pretty good at explaining things.
I think he's really good at it. Yeah. I mean, he's a fascinating guy to listen to, really, you know, and yeah.
Big time.
So Lazar goes into some detail about how the generator works, as he said. There are definitely some gray areas that I would like explained in more detail. He describes it as a platter with a pedestal in the middle, onto which is placed a hemisphere about the size of a basketball.
Like a cheese platter?
Yeah.
Like cheese Danish.
The model's just like, yeah, it's like a square silver platter, basically. He describes it as load sensing, which I took to mean that it senses when the hemisphere is placed onto the tray, but he describes it as sensing when a power source is near. So I don't know if that's some technical jargon, like load sensing would, I think that means like power, like if you turn a sensor on or something, there's a load on it, right? Or not a sensor, but a circuit, you know?
Well, I think of load sensing, I think of sensing how much weight is being pressed on something, like a scale, maybe.
Right, that's how I picture it. It's a pedestal with a
platter.
Yeah, it senses when it loads on it, and then but then Rogan asked him about it. He said, "What does that mean?" You know, and he says, "Well, it senses when a power source is near." So, as Lazar says, the stuff is borderline magic, and that there are no wires or connections or anything like that. He also describes that it is in violation of the first law of thermodynamics, as it emits no thermal radiation while generating astronomical amounts of power. I think we talked about this when I was talking about zero energy. I think that's what it means.
Yeah.
There's no output on it.
Right. Anything as anything. I understand it, that runs or that generates energy, there's always going to be a loss through heat. Like nothing can operate, as far as we know, at 100% efficiency. Exactly. Anything like the microphone I'm talking into is generating energy through the batteries, right?
Exactly, yeah.
And so the batteries themselves generate a certain amount of heat. And if the batteries worked at 100% efficiency, we would never have to replace them, right?
I don't know about that.
Okay, honestly. Maybe I'm just talking out of my hiney here, but...
But I think, some of the energy goes into creating heat, basically, from the, electrical reaction or something. I'm not a physicist.
Me neither, but, me neither.
But I love it. You know, I wish I did understand it more, honestly. But, so that's basically the best description I can find from him, but definitely it leaves me with a few questions. It still doesn't really explain to me how you turn it on or off. Especially if once it is on, you can't touch it. Would it not automatically fly up into the air and be left in the same place as the Earth moves through space if it were suddenly not involved in Earth's gravity? Or,
yeah.
I mean, maybe it's just from a lack of information about it based on his like quick explanation. But I get the impression it's kind of focused, or maybe it's only in one direction. Like I said, I'm by no means a physicist, and I obviously am missing some details about how the thing operates. He does mention that the power system naturally creates a gravitational field, or basically an anti-gravitational force, once it is turned on, which is then funneled and directed in order to fly the craft. So maybe there is only a gravitational force field in one direction until the field is focused, and then you can still access the generator itself. I don't know. This is obviously all very speculative. I really wish that he would go into a lot more detail about that, because that's the thing he's supposed to be an expert on.
Well, that's what he tried to work on for a while. I think that
for 6 months, apparently.
If I understand it, that was his task.
Right.
Was trying to figure out how the hell this thing worked.
Exactly. Right? Okay. So that's why he's so good at explaining it, maybe, but I don't even know if he knows how it works really, but.
Right. And I don't understand how much, it wasn't clear for me after watching the documentary or listening to the podcast, how much progress was made.
Right.
In terms of figuring it out. I mean,
he doesn't make clear, like at first they didn't know this, because he makes it sound like he was figuring some stuff out, you know, but I don't know what that would be.
Yeah.
And I have some questions in my mind about the structure of the generator. I mean, he explains it pretty descriptively, or he describes it well in the link that we provided in the early interview. But he claims that element 115 is the fuel that it uses. He claims that the military had 500 pounds of this stuff, although how he knows that is kind of unclear to me. I don't know if he read that, or if it was told to him, or if he saw it himself.
Well, even if he saw it, I mean, you can't just look at something and go, oh, God, that's element 115.
Right, right. Well, I mean, he was messing with, I mean, it's the fuel for it, apparently, but then I don't know where that fits into the load sensing. Maybe you put a little element 115, because I couldn't find it again, and I didn't take good enough notes, but he says in the interview, he just kind of mentions offhand, like, I was led to believe they had 500 pounds of it. I think, I can't remember where, but he said it was in the form of a triangle, like a little pyramid. So,
dude, you just take the gas cap off. There's some element 115 in there. It's that simple.
Well, what I was, now that I'm thinking about it, maybe that's what the pedestal's for. You put the little triangle on there, and then you put the hemisphere over that. I don't know.
The hemi.
Yeah, yeah. just.
I don't know what a hemi is, but I hear car people talking about hemis.
Right, right. I was going to try and say something, but I don't know how to use it in a sentence.
I'm not a car person either.
Yeah, I still can't come up with anything for a hemi. But so element 115, it's now known as moscovium, and it was only theoretical at the time of Lazar's story originally, but a few molecules of it have since been replicated in 2003. Only to instantly deteriorate as it has a really short half-life, apparently.
Incredibly unstable isotope, from
right.
What I understand.
And
I don't know what an isotope is, but I know it's incredibly unstable.
And right now, I want to make it clear, like right now, we're just going through his claims as he tells them, even though I'm putting my little skeptical comments in there. But once we get into like analyzing all the data, then we'll really start picking it apart, you know?
Sure.
So, but from what I understand, heavy elements are cooked up in the deeper levels of huge stars and are very unstable with a short half-life. This is beyond my level of comprehension, but Lazar claims that there is an island of stability where the protons and neutrons are balanced and it no longer decays.
Like an island of stability inside the alien thing? or in the universe, there's some, like there's an island of stability somewhere.
Yeah, no, basically for each isotope, or only for certain isotopes, maybe there isn't, you know, because there's different isotopes, like some of them are radioactive, like hydrogen, right? You want the certain isotope of hydrogen that's unbalanced, that's radioactive, basically, because it shoots off. I mean, this is where I don't really know what I'm talking about, but basically what he says is the protons and neutrons are balanced and it no longer decays. So that's why the half-life wouldn't be a problem. It's stable,
right?
A stable version of it.
Okay.
Because of the balance of how the nucleus is constructed, apparently. I think isotopes, right? That's if they have like extra electrons on them. I don't know.
That sounds, or neutrons. No.
Right. I mean, there's negative and positive isotopes. So yeah, maybe I think it might have to do with how many neutrons are in there, but I really don't know, obviously. And, I thought it was kind of interesting though, because it seems to match with what Tom DeLonge was said about the specialist that he works with, in that the substances they were experimenting did not seem to be made on this planet. Yeah.
And interesting.
Like I said, I'll get into this a little bit more when we're picking apart the evidence here, but,
sure.
But that's a, you know, that goes a long way to people believing him, because he said it before it was discovered technically. And then it got discovered, you know. But I have some thoughts on that.
I do too. We'll save those for
right. I'm sure everyone listening does too. But so Lazar also explains his exposure to the different craft of the base. He said that he can confirm that there were at least 9 craft on site, as all the interior doors inside the hangars were open only once, and he could see them all lined up there. He described the craft that he worked on as the Sport model, which is a classic flying saucer shape, similar to 2 saucers set rim to rim. I'm sure everyone can picture a flying saucer.
Right. And it's funny how I only hear the phrase saucer used in the UFO or UAF or UAP, context. I've never once said to anyone, hey, pass me that saucer. That's such an antiquated word, man.
That is like, weird. The only way it's really
never,
used.
I've never, ever, ever.
What about saucer full of secrets?
Ooh.
Well, I think it's because the Foo Fighters probably started with the English Air Force in World War II, right? So
right.
I think they are a lot more into saucers than we are, but
yeah.
Maybe they're just, I don't know. What happened to saucers?
And you're not talking about the Dave Grohl Foo Fighters.
No. I'm talking about the WW2 Foo Fighters that it's based on.
Mm.
As we discussed in our other podcast here. But we also, so Lazar also saw one that, he said, let me see. So he saw all these craft lined up. There were some different shapes. So he saw one that reminded him of a jello mold, one like a top hat, and one that was up on its side with what looked like a projectile hole in it. He hypothesizes that the military had tried shooting a hole in it as a test to see if they could penetrate it. But again, he doesn't really explain why that's his reasoning.
Or they were flying it around the Nevada desert and some scary neck decided to...
Or they shot it down out of the sky.
Take pot shots at it.
Yeah.
At a flying object.
Yeah. So Lazar claims that he was granted access to the inside of the craft once in order for him to look at where the generator was seated, in the hopes that it would give him more clues as to how it functioned. He said it really struck him how otherworldly or inhuman the craft was when he went inside. He said he felt like he didn't belong in there, like it wasn't meant for human beings.
And just, you know, once again, we're going to include links to Mr. Lazar's drawings of the craft layout inside the show notes for this episode.
Yeah, and they're pretty interesting. I would recommend checking it out. This one of them is really interesting, and it goes into basically like a theory on how it works and stuff. So Bob Lazar goes into some detail about the craft itself, which was a uniformly dull metallic color, both inside and out, kind of like stainless steel or brushed aluminum. He said he wasn't sure if it was a metal or ceramic, but that it felt cool to the touch, like a metal. He claims that everything in the interior looked like it had been mold injected, with no straight lines and no seams between objects like the seats or floor. Another way he described the form of the interior is as if it had been made out of wax and then melted just until it lost all the straight lines and seams. Hmm. Yeah, that's pretty cool.
Yeah.
I read something somewhere, like some confident commenter or something saying that, oh yeah, they make them out in space and they blast them with sound waves to shape them, which sounds cool to me. I don't know where, how he learned this, but
you know what I did learn from Bob Lazar? He said there's a very thin line between a metal and a ceramic.
Oh really?
Yeah.
Okay.
I remember him saying that, and that was fascinating to me because I always thought of them as two completely different forms of matter almost.
Right.
I mean,
right.
Not different in the sense of like a solid and a liquid, but I always thought metals and ceramics were, one was super durable, and
right.
a ceramic I always think of as, you know, don't drop that, it's gonna shatter.
I guess ceramic, yeah, they're pretty important for aircraft and stuff. I mean, I know ceramics can take a lot of heat without melting, I believe. I don't know. I don't know anything about it, but
I can't take the heat, man.
Physics is some pretty cool stuff. So he says that there was three levels to the saucer: the bottom section, which housed the propulsion system; the main middle section, which would be like the bridge; and the top section, which he did not have access to. Lazar speculates that the top section probably held the computing or navigation system, and the exterior of the top section had rectangular black sections that looked like windows, which he theorized were probably sensor panels. But again, I have no idea how he came to that conclusion. It does look like the top section is relatively small, judging by the drawings of the layout. The main middle section is the bridge and is the largest. The way Lazar describes it is that the generator sits in the middle, surrounded symmetrically by three seats. My favorite part of his description is just that the whole interior was small, including the seats, and seemed to be designed for someone about 3 to 4 feet high, which is creepy.
Yeah.
Each seat had a smooth, blank, roughly rectangular console in front of it, the same texture as the rest of the craft. No controls or anything like that. Around the edges or walls of this compartment were large archways. He said that while he was in the craft, there was another team working at one of the archways, and they actually made it go transparent a few times that he saw, so that it could be used as a window. It's not hard to imagine that the other archways could have been turned transparent as well for a full 360-degree view, or maybe even used as some kind of monitor or display. If they have that technology, then in the consoles could display some controls when the craft is active and have touch screens. Just kind of thinking out loud here. You know, doesn't seem very far-fetched to me.
Okay.
I like to imagine the description of the craft from the Rendlesham Forest incident, which was described as looking similar to a lava lamp with lights moving around inside a clear exterior. I suppose another option, if there were no physical controls on the consoles, would be if the craft was mind controlled by some kind of synaptic connection or something like that, which you hear a lot with Grays, is staring and like talking to you through your mind.
Yeah. Or if there was some kind of Iron Man, Tony Stark-ish, like... HUD heads up display or whatever it is, you know,
totally.
Like,
or
that,
like, yeah, like Prometheus basically.
Yeah,
or,
right. You never saw anything about Lazar saying like a joystick or any kind of,
no, he's pretty specific. I believe it's in the Lazar interview, or maybe it's the other interview that we have the link to, but
the Rogan interview.
Rogan Lazar interview.
Right.
But he specifically mentions it's, he didn't see any controls or anything like that, just smooth consoles.
Okay, I might be talking out my butt here, but for some reason I thought he saw some kind of, like, not like a joystick, but some kind of handprint type thing. I might be confusing that with like a different incident.
It could be,
yeah.
But I don't remember. There was a joystick with the fire in the sky guys.
That might be what I was thinking of. Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah. I totally trust your research, man.
I don't know if I do. It's all, man. But I remember he did specifically say there was, you know, wasn't anything there that he could see.
Cool. Thanks for clarifying for me.
Yeah. And so Lazar said that the interior was uncomfortable, as it seemed to be designed to accommodate beings who were only 3 to 4 feet high. So the only way he could access the lower propulsion segment was by hanging his torso upside down through the access hatch in the middle, in the floor, in the middle section, and looking at it upside down. I don't know if that was very clear, but basically, you know, he had to poke his head down in the bottom section, look around at it.
Like he's going into a crawl space or something, like almost like from above.
Right.
Like, okay.
Not the best way to observe something, I don't think.
Yeah.
With blood rushing to your head. But
he said it. So just to clarify, you said it. Well, he said it was 3 to 4 feet high. Did he say how long it was? I might have missed that part.
You know what? I don't have that, but there are... Shoot.
I can't remember him.
Yeah, I'm not... I don't remember how big it was, honestly.
Like, are we talking?
There might be some dimensions on the drawings.
Okay.
But yeah, I didn't really get into that, honestly. I know he said, a lot of them were very similar shaped, and he called that one the sport model because it's the smallest, but there was bigger ones too down the hallway, he said.
Got it.
Which probably would have been nice to look at, but
yeah, they got the sport model. They got to have like the jalopy one too. It's like spewing crap everywhere.
I want to say that at some point he said those consoles were right above where the propulsion. Well, let me get into how the propulsion looks. But he's kind of fixated on the access hatchway itself, as it was the one thing in the ship that he could immediately understand how it functioned. You know, it didn't blow his mind when he saw it. He described it as kind of functioning like a tic-tac-toe-shaped cardboard that comes in a large box of beer, that it's latticed and strong when you push on the top. Not that it's made out of cardboard, but just like that shape where you can fold it from the side, but it's strong when you push down on it.
Oh, okay. Gotcha.
So then you just kind of stick your finger in there. It's latticed. You stick your finger in there and just pull it to the side, and you can access it, basically, which is smart. And he was really impressed because it was so elegant and like I said, mechanical as opposed to magical or whatever. I think he said there was a hexagon pattern on the floor as well, which is interesting since he said everything was smooth and contoured.
Yeah.
But I guess you could describe a beehive that way and it's still hexagonal. I don't know. I'd like to see it. That's for sure.
Yeah. It
sounds simple and elegant to me, and Lazar says in an interview that everything in the craft was about as simple and elegant as you could think of. No decorations or anything like that, and a very efficient use of space.
God, dude, why didn't they have the big fuzzy dice hanging from the rearview mirror?
Right. maybe they took all that out before they let Lazar have access to it. Who knows what? There's all these pinups of grays and stuff.
Or before the grays bailed out over the Nevada desert, they were like, we can't have them seeing this kind of stuff.
He did say there was some ashtrays built into the consoles.
I wonder what the grays smoked. they probably smoked...
Element 127 or something.
Zeta Reticuli 2 Spirit.
Right. So the way that Lazar describes the bottom section itself is that under each seat and console, there was what looked like an upside down trash cans hanging from rods, which directed the flow of the gravity field generated by the power source. So it sounds like the anti-gravity field is created by the generator, is directed through these three movable elements, and that's how it can be steered. He claims that the ship would function differently when near a planet's gravitational field than when it is in the vacuum of space. Lazar says that's why the UFO videos appear to bounce sometimes, because they would be affected by differences in mass density on the surface of the Earth. How's it going, guys? This is Grant from the podcast, and I just want to take a minute to tell you about our sponsor, CBGW Guitars. You can order these on Etsy, and as you hear in the background here, they're three-string slide guitars. They're great for rock, and blues, folk music, pretty much anything you want to play. And they're a lot of fun. They're pretty addictive. They're really easy to learn. They make great gifts. They're beautiful, just hanging on the wall. They're made from actual cigar boxes, not guitars. But, full disclosure, I make them myself by hand, and I run CBGW, so if you just wanted to donate to the podcast or throw some cash my way, I would appreciate it. But yeah, as you can hear, they're great instruments. You can find them on Etsy, and I'll put the link in the notes here, but just search CBGW on Etsy and you'll find the shop. Thanks for listening, and I'll let myself take you out with this soft melody. Lazar also claims that when traveling through space, it would move bottom first, so that if it was moving away from you, then it would be pointing its top surface at you. This is beyond my understanding, but he claims that while this craft is operating and creating its own gravitational bubble, you would in essence be in your own separate reality, removed from any G-forces that would normally affect you.
Wow. So I bet if you were inside the craft at that point, it would just seem like you were flying, you wouldn't be able to see any of the craft itself, right?
If you're inside, well, I don't.
If you're the pilot,
I don't know about that. I think it's more like that's why it can do 90 degree angle turns at high speeds without killing all the occupants inside from the G forces. Is the point of that? Yeah.
Okay.
I think. Yeah, the other thing, I think you're referencing the Tom DeLonge's book, or right? The is that what you mean? Or,
yeah. Well, yeah. That's probably where I heard it.
But
yeah.
I think you're inside this bubble, so you're going to be on your own reality, and then everything outside is going to be affected by different laws of physics, basically, or different gravity, at least. I mean, you'd have to ask Bob Lazar, honestly, to clarify that.
Sure. Yeah, and we're, once again, guys, we're going to include a link to a page that goes into more depth about how the propulsion system worked. But again, to me anyway, it's still pretty unclear where all the information comes from based on how Bob Lazar describes the events. But, you know, it's some interesting stuff, even if all of it is theoretical.
Absolutely. Know? Yeah. No, it's really fascinating. Yeah. And, I mean, it's a website called www.gravitywarpdrive.com. So, but this guy really breaks it down. It's pretty interesting. And it has a really good drawing of the craft as Lazar explains it. Or describes it, I should say. So, as I mentioned before, Lazar advised that he personally saw 9 different craft. Again, he only had one opportunity when one day all the interior doors were open and he could look down the court and see them all lined up. He did say, as I said, there were similar shaped ones that were different sizes, all larger than the one that he had experimented on or examined, and a few other different shapes that I mentioned before. Lazar also had a chance to witness a small test flight of the Sport model on the same day that he witnessed the other craft, meaning the same day that he looked down and saw the 9 other ones, or the 8 other ones. He stated that there was a slight hiss when the craft left the ground, but then was completely silent when it was floating in the air. The flight that he witnessed was not very extraordinary, except for that he was watching a flying saucer fly.
Right.
As the craft just lifted straight up off the ground and then moved 6 feet to the left and 6 feet to the right before settling back down. He knows there was a human pilot inside as someone was talking to the pilot with a radio, which Bob Lazar found strange since he thought that the gravitational field should interfere with the radio waves. He also wondered how the pilot fit inside of the craft to fly it and said it probably wasn't very comfortable since it was so cramped inside.
They probably just put that bagel freak out guy in there. Did you see that?
No.
There's a viral video going on. 4'11" guy having a freak out at like a bagel place.
Yeah, yeah. I'm sure most pilots are pretty small, actually, so maybe they could find some guy
right
sitting there, or he's just laying down in a lazy boy or something.
Yeah.
Another detail that's unclear to me is that Lazar claims he could see a blue discharge emitting from the bottom of the craft while it was flying, which he assumes was emitted from the air around the craft being broken down by all the power that was being emitted, kind of how lightning works. He describes this more as a physicist would. I guess it makes sense. Lazar also describes being able to see the 3 emitters while the craft was in flight, but that he doesn't mention a clear bottom or opening or anything like that. So I have to assume that he means he could see the 3 separate areas of discharge, not the apparatus themselves. Like you said, you were under the impression that they were just sitting there on the bottom, but I mean, from the way he described it, I pictured it being contained inside. I mean, I've looked at a lot of drawings of this too, so I'm assuming that's how it was, you know, but I don't know. These last details are explained in the book excerpt available on his autobiography's Amazon page. I didn't put the name of it, but I think it's called Dreamland.
His autobiography?
Yeah.
Okay.
And one detail that leapt out at me while reading the excerpt, I don't know how to say that, was during the Rogan interview, Lazar claims that he was close enough to the radio console to see what frequency was being used. But in the book, he describes it as being what must have been a radio and not being close enough to hear what the communications officer was saying to the pilot, assuming that was actually who the comms officer was communicating with.
Huh. Here's an interesting theory that just popped in my head. Maybe the pilot wasn't actually inside the craft. Maybe they found a way to control it remotely. Meaning the people who were trying to reverse engineer it. Maybe.
And I was thinking maybe they had a radio comm to like some guy with smoke signals or lights, you know, that were directing the pilot who could see him or something, but not communicated with them through the probably not smoke signals.
Or you mean like those big glow sticks that they use at the airport
where they kind of
exactly know, the beginning semaphore of Top Gun thing, or whatever. Yeah, or
at the beginning of Airplane, where that guy sends the airplane right through. Yeah. Big shout out to Airplane, by the way. You guys need to rewatch that movie if you haven't seen it recently. I just rewatch it again. That movie's funny as hell. Anyway,
sorry. Yeah, we gotta wait till we get sponsors to start.
Yeah, start that's true.
About. So,
big shout out to Leslie Nielsen,
Paramount, sorry. If you're listening. let's see. So in the book, yeah, he describes it was must have been a radio. But yeah, he seems so sure about it now, or in person, he's always like, yeah, they were talking to him on the radio, you know. So I don't know, I just think it's interesting. We'll include a link to the book too as well for you guys. I do have to say that if Lazar's claims are true, then this seems like a ridiculous way to back engineer something. The compartmentalization, I mean. How are you supposed to figure out how something works? Like, if you're trying to back engineer an SR-71 or any jet or a car or even a motorcycle, like he said, how do you do it without cutting the craft open, seeing the inner workings? Or, I mean, just stare at the engine and run some tests on it, but not look at the throttle system or pilot controls or anything like that, and only observing how it behaves in flight once, and you're supposed to crack the code on there? I mean, that seems pretty impossible to me.
Yeah, I've never tried to reverse engineer anything. I was never a very mechanically minded kid or anything, but anyone who was mechanically minded, you always hear about people saying, oh yeah, I love to take things apart and put them back together again. And it seems like that's how these things are done, mostly, is you take them apart and...
Right. You know, I mean, he says himself he can't see any control, so how are you supposed to figure out how the generator flies it? You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Or the propulsion system. I mean, how would you figure out a jet propulsion system without looking at the joystick and how it's connected to the afterburners and all that stuff?
Yeah.
He doesn't really elaborate very much on what kind of experiments they would run either, as far as I could find. He mentions in interviews and in the book, that the compartmentalization is a horrible way to investigate something, and that he believes the government is shooting itself in the foot by running the research this way. I think it is striking that Lazar describes the flight of the craft as if he is an uninformed observer, as opposed to someone who is tasked with back engineering the vehicle.
Yeah.
One other thing that Bob Lazar mentions that he saw with his own eyes was that once while walking down the corridor, he glanced into one of those small square windows with wires running through them in a doorway. And he saw two researchers looking down at a small body with long arms. In earlier interviews, I believe he claims that he saw an alien body being autopsied, but he seems to have walked that back and now assumes that it was just a dummy that was being used for research, which he makes clear in the Rogan interview.
Yeah, I didn't get that. Like he thought that it was a dummy alien for research.
Yeah, yeah. Which I guess, you know, you look at a model of it instead of looking at an actual alien body or something, or they were trying to figure out how comfortable the seats were for the aliens, maybe. I don't know. But I thought it was, I mean, I'll get into it a little bit, but I thought it was interesting how there was little discussion there was about aliens on the Rogan interview or the, because that seems like a big part of his original claims, which I was hoping the movie would get into, but we'll discuss all that later. So that basically covers all of the claims that he can verify as true, as he says it, because he's seen it with his own eyes. So he knows for a fact for it to be real.
Okay. So that's all his firsthand stuff.
Yeah.
Exactly. Okay. All right. Well, I say we wrap it up for this week. You know, once again, guys, if you enjoy the show, I know it's that time, but if you guys like the show, please, you know, really appreciate it. Just like it and subscribe and leave some comments for us. This is a two-parter episode, obviously.
Maybe even a three. I got a lot of stuff here. Yeah. You know, I don't want to rush through it too much.
Right. So, let us know, what do you think of the format? If you guys want one long episode, like a big 3-hour long blaster for you to drive from here to Timbuktu, 3 hours.
Rachel, Nevada.
Yeah, San Diego to Rachel. You can make it in 3 hours.
Yeah, you heard about that Area 54 thing on Facebook. It's all over the news and everything.
The
big deal.
Where they storm, you mean the people storming Area 51?
Area 51, yeah. I always call it 54, yeah.
Studio 54?
Yeah, exactly.
People are going to storm Studio 54?
Yeah.
Oh, God. Well, yeah, we should talk about the storming of Area 51 in the future also. That's not going to happen until September, I guess.
Oh, really?
Yeah. Okay. I think it's a ways off. But
Hopefully that's misinformation, because that's a bad way to plan an operation there.
Yeah. Yeah. But anyway, thank you guys for listening. And once again, just let us know what you think of the format. Like and subscribe. And peace out.